We have our brother Joe Schell this morning, and he is going to speak on In the Hebrews, Part 3. In the Hebrew, Part 3, Brother Joe. And there's a handout, so if you don't have a handout, raise your hand, and ones will be brought to you.
Thank you. As Brother Dan mentioned, this is Part 3 of a continuing talk. I'm using the same handout. Now, this will be the third and final time. And just as a little refresher as to how this all started, was I was looking for more understanding of the concept of Armageddon. And so when I looked at the text, which I have looked at over the years, that is the only use of the word, which is in Revelation 16:16, which reads, "And he gathered them together in a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon." I felt I did not have enough understanding about this concept, and so I looked at any way by which more could be revealed on this. And I thought I would try looking at that word Hebrew, and that's how this began. So essentially what I have done is to see if possibly this is what you might call a key word, so to speak, that the uses of this word, particularly in the New Testament as it's used, would convey principles by which we could understand Armageddon. Because it is a very complex subject, one that can convey many different images in our mind. And so in the search for clarity, I'm going to see what my endeavor was, is to see if all of the uses of the word Hebrew in the New Testament revealed more meaning about this word. And so my intent is simply to let these scriptures that you see on your handout do the speaking. But, of course, I'm doing the interpreting. And so you're seeing it through my mind to determine what these words convey. And thus far, we have covered the first page of this handout. We've done Luke 2:38 through John 19:20, and when we get there today, we're going to be on Acts 21. But before we do that, in letting these scriptures speak, I want to give you what I feel the general trend that they're speaking, and that is, these are factors that are going to influence the Hebrew, that is the Jewish heart, in such a way that leads them to draw positive conclusions about God, about their Messiah, and about their relationship with those things, and their relationship with the rest of mankind. Because, as you know, there has to be an agreement of an acceptance of their Messiah before there can ever be a kingdom. Before there can be an earthly phase of the kingdom, there has to be an acceptance of that Messiah. And so this word, Armageddon, I'm going to be using probably in a different way than what you are familiar with. And so I wanted you to know that the general trend in which I'm going has to do with an internal heart condition, rather than a specific external event. And essentially, this condition of heart will enable them to fulfill the obligations to the new covenant, without which, again, there cannot be a kingdom. And so I wanted to remind you, or refresh your memory in the sense of the context of this phrase, Armageddon, where it's located in the scriptures. In Revelation, So highly symbolic, but it's in a section of Revelation known as the seven last plagues. And therefore, you can group them together. They have a common purpose, these plagues. And there is a certain set of conditions and timing involved with them. And I only want to have you note one thing about these plagues, about a condition that exists during the time that these plagues are being poured out. And I will mention, too, that I believe these plagues are being poured out as we speak. But in Revelation 15, something is mentioned which sets the stage. In Revelation 15, 8, let's read 7 and 8. And one of the four beasts gave unto the seven angels seven golden vials full of the wrath of God, who liveth forever and ever. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power. And no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled. So you have a condition where this temple is filled with smoke. And so this is a fulfillment, if you will, of an Old Testament text in the book of 1 Kings. The eighth chapter of 1 Kings, you don't have to go there, but when you have a chance, read that chapter, because it describes a situation which Revelation, the Revelator, is picking up on, and I want you to note the condition that exists then and seeing how it has application now, that we're talking about the same time frame, a fulfillment of that antitype, if you will. This is Solomon speaking. He just completed the temple. And he just brought the Ark of the Covenant into the Most Holy. And I'm going to pick up and read a couple of verses, 10, 11, and 12. And it came to pass when the priests were come out of the holy place, that is, right after they brought in the Ark of the Covenant into the temple, that the cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord had filled the house of the Lord. Then spake Solomon, the Lord said that he would dwell in thick darkness. Now here I want you to notice the similarity with Revelation, with our text. Here is where, in the Old Testament, we have the account of the same thing happening, that the tabernacle was filled with smoke, and when something is filled with smoke, you can't do anything in there. You don't know what's going on in there. You can't see in there. And the priest can't minister any covenant. And so, you know, we're not going to have a new covenant until these plagues are poured out and all this smoke gets out of the tabernacle, in essence. So we are living in the time when this tabernacle is filled with smoke. And also, the sixth plague where this Revelation text about Armageddon is the equivalent of the second to the last plague in Israel. And that plague was darkness. I'm mentioning this to set the stage for our understanding of this text, that we're in a time frame when this is when there's smoke and darkness, so that we really don't know what's going on. If we look at the fulfillment, the equivalent, the antitype of the original plagues and draw it up to now, we're in darkness. So we really can't say, and I cannot say, standing here, I cannot speak with absolute authority, but I'm just telling you what I think the scriptures are speaking to me. That's all I can do. So as to influence and motivate you into thinking more on this subject. Well, then Solomon gave a long prayer. And in 56, he says, blessed be the Lord. He's speaking to all of Israel now while this tabernacle is filled with smoke. And this conveys the idea of the plagues, and particularly this condition that we're drawing to that involves the heart of the Jewish people. He says in 56, "Blessed be the Lord that hath given rest unto his people Israel according to all that he promised. There hath not failed one word of all his good promise, which he promised by the hand of Moses his servant. The Lord our God be with us, and he was with our fathers. Let him not leave us nor forsake us." And notice this next phrase, "that he may incline our hearts unto him." That he may incline our hearts unto him to walk in all his ways and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments which he commands our fathers. This indicates the work. I'm going to, in essence, say that the concept of all of these scriptures that are on your handout are conveying this work of inclining the Jewish heart unto God. God is doing it. He's doing it in darkness, and he's doing it in a tabernacle that's filled with smoke and can't be ministered unto a covenant yet. This is the context, the background of where we're at with this Armageddon. And I would add that Israel's minds and hearts are blinded. And in essence, we are ignorant of how God is dealing with that. So we are not to think of how God is supposed to be doing this. But I think there's a way, I think these scriptures indicate how he's doing it. In Romans, Paul says, "For I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles become in." That means till the church is complete. And that's what this smoke and darkness is waiting for, until the church is complete. And then the blindness can be removed. But until then, he is dealing with the hearts and setting up the process so at the right time, the blindness can be removed. It's not done in ignorance. It's going to be done with knowledge. And it's going to be done with a pure heart. So I wanted to also, in a flashback of sorts, go back into our very first text in on the front of your handout, which was Luke 23:38, and just remind you that when I started looking at this, I kept these texts in scriptural order, and that's how I'm going to continue to use them. And the first thing was kind of amazing to me in the sense that the context for this first verse or first text was the Passover, because the crucifixion was at the Passover. And I thought that, at least metaphorically or symbolically, very appropriate, because it is a time when the firstborn class is complete. And that's what we're looking for symbolically. When the firstborn class is totally complete, then that blood can be released and be applied to the world of mankind. And of course, that's going to be through Israel. And that's how this situation is set up. And I'm going to be mentioning the Passover at least a couple of more times before I'm done now, because I feel that it is the context by which it happens. And I said that to say this, because last time when we were dealing with the text in John 19, I was talking about 1 Chronicles 21. I have to apologize today that it's hard for me to, it's hard probably to follow me where I'm going, because I'm jumping around in so many texts. I don't really apologize for that, but I just, because that is the nature of this study that the scriptures led me to. However, if you just keep in mind that the element that ties all of these texts together is a heart condition. Every one of these is going to have something to do with the Jewish heart in preparing them to accept their Messiah. I want to revisit 1 Chronicles 21. And I believe it foretells a scene in the end time, David is the main character, and he is representing those who, in the antitype to this scene, are going to be in the position to take the same action that David did, because they were facing destruction. And God gave him some choices, and he made his choice. And the result was that God in 1 Chronicles 21:15, that God was destroying Israel with a destroying angel. He sent a destroyer to destroy angel, to destroy Israel, And so he didn't, of course. He stopped the destruction. But I wanted to ask you, where else do you know of where there's a destroying angel? In the Passover story. And what was the only thing that kept the firstborn alive? What was the only thing that kept the firstborn alive when that angel was destroying during the last plague?
The blood.
Okay, take that lesson and apply it to the end time prophecy here, portrayed by David in 1 Chronicles 21. When you get a chance, read 1 Chronicles, the 21st chapter, and read this account. And then apply it to the end time. I believe, I didn't mention this the last time because I didn't see this feature in this. And so that's why I wanted to mention it now, because it ties in a key element by which the kingdom can begin, is that they have to recognize that it's the blood that is going to save them from the destroying angel. There are, of course, two applications of the blood of Christ. And the reason that the context is the Passover, it's because Jesus is the Passover lamb. And they have to recognize that fact and see the beauty in that blood, rather than it just being an external thing, a ceremony that they go through once a year. They have to see that as actually the thing that's going to save their lives, and actually believe that, and see that they're going to have to apply it to themselves. And from there, the kingdom can begin and then be applied to others. So I wanted to just give you that indication of another indication of the Passover being part of this. And possibly this is indicating where the second application of the blood, it seems to be an indication of that. Also, as long as we're on 1 Chronicles 21, and I made this point a little bit, but in the end, David here is at where God tells him to make to build a temple and offer a sacrifice. And it happens to be exactly where Solomon's temple was built. And he offers, as a proof, that he accepts the concept that a purchase was made. He insists, after this land was offered to him by the owner of this land to build this temple, which was a threshing floor, he insists on buying it, full purchase price. I believe harmonizing, or at least giving evidence of the fact that David in this scene is recognizing the price that was paid for that blood to save them from the destruction. And that piece of land became the land where Solomon's temple was built. And that piece of land is not in the hand of Israel today and needs to be purchased. This is a fact. And so it, again, falls into this closed end-time scene wherein there's an acceptance of the blood of Christ, the Passover lamb, and a purchase of this place, this geographic place where the temple, which is now called the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, resides. And so I wanted to add that picture because it builds into this. In the last few months, I realized that I left a couple of scriptures out of this. And so I wanted to, in case you were paying attention, no one told me, but I wanted to catch up on that. Because when I looked in my strong concordance for all the words using Hebrew in the New Testament, I didn't look at the listing under Hebrews, plural, which uses the same Greek. And there's two in particular that I wanted to mention. And since I'm doing this in scriptural order, I wanted to mention one of those texts right now, because it's Acts 6:1. It's not on your handout, because I missed it. And it reads, "And in those days, when the number of the disciples was multiplied, there arose a murmuring of the Grecians against the Hebrews, because their widows were neglected in the daily ministration." I have virtually no comment. I don't know what it means. The other one that I missed, I am going to have a comment on, but I don't have a comment for this one. If you have something, you let me know. Let's go on to Acts 21. There's two texts here. 21:40 and 22:2 goes into the next chapter. It's all one account. Now, the next few scriptures are about the Apostle Paul. And I want to mention something about the Apostle Paul. Later on, we are going to mention Philippians 3:5. Just jumping ahead a little bit in preview. Paul, I believe, is the prototype for all Hebrews in regards to their conversion to Christ. Back at the Passover, there was a sign put above Jesus' head, put up there by Pilate. "This is the King of the Jews." And it was written in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek, representing three categories of people, three classes of people. And the Hebrews are simply the ones who are prepared to accept their Messiah for his position and what he was and what he is and what will become. Paul, if you jump down to Philippians 3:5, he describes himself as a Hebrew of the Hebrews, essentially saying, "You want to see a Hebrew? I'm it." So you can look at the life of the Apostle Paul and his activities and see how one can go from strict Judaism into someone who can see that Jesus was their Messiah. He did it. So simply by following his steps and the reasonings that come out of his epistles and so forth, you can come to an understanding what goes on in the Jewish mind so as to come into this heart condition. But also, I wanted to point out, in case I forget to later, by asking you a question, did Paul show any outward signs of converting to Christ before his actual conversion on the road to Damascus? I would say no, none whatsoever. He was persecuting Christians. And yet, the fact remains that he converted just like that. Of course, the circumstances were very good for him, because the Lord essentially appeared to him in a very dramatic way. Yet, my point in this is that you cannot see any outward signs. We have indications going on now in Israel of activities suggesting what it means, who was this Messiah, and relating it to Jesus and so forth. But we cannot read the heart. We could not read Paul's heart. He was opposing Christ in every way. And yet, God knew his heart and that it was ready for that conversion. And so again, our human eyes can only perceive so much. Acts 21:40 through 22:2. And when he had given him license, Paul stood on the stairs and beckoned with the hand unto the people. And when there was made a great silence, he spake unto them in the Hebrew tongue, saying, Men, brethren, and fathers, hear ye my defense, which I make now unto you. And when they heard that he spake in the Hebrew tongue to them, they kept the more silence. First here, I want you to note that Paul here is in Jerusalem, and he's speaking, his audience is a number of angry Jews. And these Jews were ready to kill him. And this scene represents, I would say, a conversion process. In the following verses, in verse 3, he says, I am verily a man which am a Jew, born in Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, yet brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, and taught according to the perfect manner of the law of our fathers, and was zealous towards God, as ye are all this day. So he affirms in what he was. And then he's going to explain the conversion process. And then he relates the encounter that he had with the Lord on the road to Damascus. And then there's an important result of that. In verses 13 to 15... came unto me and stood and said unto me, Brother Saul, receive thy sight. That's when he went into the city, and the one he met said, Brother Paul, Saul, receive thy sight. And the same hour I looked up upon him. And I want you to recall also the text we read from Romans 11:25, when blindness will be removed from Israel. So here is a connection here to, now we can see. He saw the Lord. And he said in 14, the God of our fathers hath chosen thee that thou should, and I want you to notice three things. This is the end result of this conversion process of a Jew. I'm reading from 22:14, that thou shouldest, one, know his will, and two, see that just one. And three, hear the voice of his mouth. Paul did. And he was converted then and there. In a miraculous way, of course. But I believe the steps, it's showing the steps of the process by which the Hebrew mind can absorb Jesus. And I missed in verse 15, number 4, part of this process. For thou shalt, 4, be a witness unto all men of what hast thou seen and heard. Paul did this. And Israel will do the same thing for the rest of mankind. They will be a witness unto God. And the world will see what it means to be a Jew. A true Jew. A true Hebrew. Now, also, going back into 21:40, I'll just read it here. And when he had given him license, Paul stood on the stairs and beckoned with the hand unto the people. And when there was made a great silence, he spake unto them in the Hebrew tongue, saying, Men, brethren, and fathers, hear ye my defense, which I make unto you now. And when they heard that he spake in the Hebrew tongue, they kept the more silence. The other point I want to make about this text is that the Hebrew language in itself is a mechanism by which God deals with his Hebrew people. I am not an expert on the Hebrew language by any means. But there are people who are. And I heard some interesting comments from a rabbi in regards to the Hebrew language. And this man was very proficient in it. And I just wanted to relate some of the points that he makes about the Hebrew language. Every letter means something. Every letter has a numerical value. These are facts. But the conclusions that he draws from it are that by it you can define reality. You can define who we are. It defines our relationship to God. This is this rabbi speaking about the Hebrew language. It shows the relationship between man and woman. It always shows that there's more to come. And that's the way it is with God. We cannot be finite in our understanding of God. There's always something more. There's always something we don't understand. We're always looking for more, and God is going to provide it. In essence, he says that this language could not have been created by man. It is God's language that he created to deal with his chosen people. And so the language itself is going to be a factor in converting the Hebrews. Next verse, Acts 26:14. And this again is relating his conversion, but I again am taking them in scriptural order. I described this before as a vision. You know, we're looking through a glass darkly. And these scriptures are painting a vision of what the conversion process would be. And to me, it's a vision. And you may see things a little differently and see something that I don't. But this is a vision. And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking unto me and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks. And the lesson here, now this is Jesus speaking. He sets the precedent for using the Hebrew tongue in converting Paul, the prototypical Hebrew. And the main lesson right up front is that Christ has many members. And this is something that the Hebrew mind at the moment shows no evidence of accepting, which is something they will have to accept before they can accept the Messiah, that he is made up of many different members. Just a short quote from a reprint article, 2968. It will be revealed to them. I want to preface this, because when Brother Russell wrote this, he wasn't thinking in my scheme of things. I'm having a dual application of all these scriptures. I don't know if you're aware of that. All these scriptures have an application that we're familiar with. But I'm taking it and doing something else with it. I admit that. But I don't apologize because I see harmony in it. But when Brother wrote this comment, he was talking about Christians for the gospel age. But I'm applying it to the next age. He says, talking about this verse, it will be revealed to them because they are not of the wicked, but are, like Saul of Tarsus, true children of God, whose zeal for him has been misdirected, misguided, misused. Some may kick against the pricks of facts, evidence, conscience, etc., longer than others. But eventually the Lord will grant to each of them some experience or trial, the bitter experience of which will prepare them to see the light, the truth, in the right direction. We know there are more experiences for Israel to come by which they can come into this same condition. But it comes through experiences. And until then, we can have a very hard head in regards to discriminating against others and how they come to God. So it's that pricks of the conscience that is keeping them back from seeing many things. Their conscience will not allow them to understand certain things or accept certain things. But until they do, there can be no conversion. Now, here's another verse that I missed. It's 2 Corinthians 11:22. Paul again speaking. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. And that's, I think, the important point right there, is that Israel will have to see themselves as the seed of Abraham in order to fully understand the promise and who they are and how they fit in with the plan of God. They'll understand the two salvations. Now let's go to Philippians 3:5 on your handout. Paul speaking again, circumcised the eighth day, the stock of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of the Hebrews, as touching the law of Pharisee. Circumcision began with Abraham. So it's appropriate here that we just mentioned the seed of Abraham. And you can read about this in Genesis, the 17th chapter. I will not read it, but God gives the practice of circumcision to Abraham. And in essence, when you get a chance, read this if you want to know about circumcision. In essence, what it means is, well, let's say what it means to the Jews. It means you're entering into a covenant. It means you have a covenant with God. Jews practice circumcision to this day. And through this fact will become more clear to them as they see them connected to Abraham. Because certainly it is the promise to Abraham by which every blessing that has come and will come to them. It is through Abraham. It connects them to the covenant through Abraham to God. But there's a second point about this. And again, Paul makes this point in Romans, the second chapter, 28 and 29. And this perhaps is one of the most important points about being a Jew now and being a Hebrew ready to accept their Messiah fully. And that is, Paul says, "For he is not a Jew which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew which is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, and not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God." So being a Jew, Paul is saying, is not what you are on the outside. It's what you are on the inside, in the heart. There's one more lesson about this, because you're circumcised on the eighth day. And we're running out of time. But essentially, the significance of the eighth day, which I believe is combined with this, is the fact that in the Feast of Tabernacles, it was a week-long celebration, and in the eighth day, they had a special celebration. And we don't have time to get into it, but it's really representing the millennial kingdom and all the blessings that are to come. Because during the first 7 days, there was sacrifices and so forth. And on the last, on the eighth day, it was the celebration, the countenance went from one of dire to one of gladness. And that will be the case. That's what they're circumcised for. It's like that's what they're circumcised for. The eighth day. The eighth day that's yet to come, future. Revelation 9:11. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. When I read that, I said, what on earth does that have to do with the Hebrew heart? But it has the word Hebrew in it, so I have to use it, right? Well, I see now how it fits. I mentioned that all of these texts on your handout, I'm using them in an additional application than how they're originally written. But also, the premise behind all of these texts is that all of these texts are essentially history. They're talking about something that actually happened, so as taking the understanding of those and applying it to the thing that we don't understand, and that is Armageddon. Because that's where I started from, because I didn't understand that. And so these are essentially things that have already happened that we're taking the lesson from and applying it to the end thing that we want to know about. And this is history. Even though it's prophetic, it's something that has happened. This is taking place during the time of the fifth trumpeter. So this happened back in the 1300s AD. It's history. So I'm just taking that lesson from history and applying it also. And it's the entire, beginning in the beginning of the ninth chapter that talks about this account. It's very complex, so I'm not going to try to read it or describe it, other than to say that our understanding of who this person was, and those who do a lot of research on Revelation, have an idea about who all the trumpeters are. And there's very, very strong evidence to suggest that this trumpeter was John Wycliffe. He lived in the 1300s. And he had followers, and he is noteworthy for having translated the Bible. And if you, when you read about John Wycliffe, he was a prototype reformer, so to speak, against papacy. But that's not the aspect that I see. What I see about John Wycliffe is the fact that he published a Bible. He was criticized for it. But he was the first one, really, to take the Old and New Testament and put them into a final product, like the thing in front of you. And this had a profound effect. Now, if you read the very next verse, in Revelation 9:12, 9:1-11 talks about this trumpeter. And then in 12, he says, one woe is past, and behold, there come two woes more hereafter. This is significant too, because the plagues in Egypt have prototypes. There was 10. Revelation talks of 7. But the woes, which are numbered in 3, come before the plagues. So we logically look at these 3 woes and add them to the 7 to complete our 10. Looking at the entirety of the plagues and their prototype, this is the equivalent of the first plague, which happened. The first 3 plagues in Egypt happened before the Exodus, while the Egyptians were living in Hebrews were living in Egypt. The first three plagues happened to both the Egyptians and the Hebrews. So the equivalent happens to both. It is happening to Israel, and it is happening to the world. Because that's what Egypt represented before the Exodus. The entire Satan's empire. The plague exists in the fact that you have Hebrew and Greek, the text says. His name was Abaddon in the Hebrew tongue and Apollyon in the Greek tongue. Both those words mean destroyer. He was destroying error. But the plague, I believe, consists in the fact that today, what you have in the world is that you have Jewish people who do not accept the New Testament. Any of its concepts, any of its teachings, especially in regards to their Messiah, it doesn't exist. That's a plague. They don't know what to do with that concept. It's there in black and white, in plain Hebrew, right in front of them, but they can't accept it. And on conversely, the plague is on the Christian world too. Anyone who accepts the New Testament cannot see how Israel fits into the plan of God. They will play politically correct with Israel and give them their due as a nation among nations. But to see them in their true role, no, they can't see it. This is a plague that has existed since the 1300s that began when John Wycliffe put the Old and New Testaments together, and which we have until this day. We can't harmonize it. We can harmonize it. The world can't harmonize it. That's why they're subsisting under this plague. My point is, this is something that Israel will get over. This is a criteria for conversion, is that they have to accept every New Testament concept. And certainly Paul promulgated all those New Testament concepts of being the perfect Jew and yet becoming a total immersed Christian out of it. For now, it's a plague. Revelation 16:16. There's more that can be said about all of these, but I wanted to get to this point now because we're running out of time. And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. The concept that this definition that I'm giving to this word implies what I'm suggesting, an internal heart condition. There has to be something in this scripture that has not been generally seen. I want to suggest two things that are not generally seen about this scripture and its context. And the number one is that when we read the previous verses, for they are the spirits. Mind you, we're in the sixth plague now. This is the second to the last plague, the time that we're living. The time that we are now living. For they are the spirits of devils working miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. That's an activity which I believe is future. But the next verse, there's gathering going on now for something that's to happen in the future. But the next verse is Jesus speaking. If you have red letters in your Bible, it's verse 15 is in red. I'm not going to read it. I'm going to jump right to 16. Because when John the Revelator was writing Revelation, he was interrupted at certain times. But his narrative doesn't get interrupted. So you can go right from 14 to 16 and read, and he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. So the he becomes the antecedent to God Almighty, the last word, the last name in 14. So you have two different gatherings going on. There is a gathering to this battle, whatever that battle means. But it's two separate gatherings. And notice also that the tense. Now, I know in the King James and in the Diaglot, the tense regarding these two words. Because in 14, it says, working miracles which go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them. My point is that this is to gather them, putting this in a future tense. But in 16, speaking of God, and he, God, gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. That's present tense. This is the sixth plague. That's now. I don't believe it's a future event. Also, Armageddon, we're running quickly out of time. And I was going to get to Zechariah 12:8 and talk about how this Hebrew word, how the word Armageddon, which is really not a Hebrew word, it's a transliteration of two Hebrew words, meaning mountain of Megiddo, and talk about Megiddo. And the only reference to Megiddo in old end time prophecy is that in Zechariah 12:8-11, and the result of it is a mourning for. I'm just going to read Zechariah 12:11. In that day there should be a great mourning in Jerusalem, as the mourning of Hadad-Rim in the valley of Megiddon. And that is a reference that ties into an account of King Josiah dying in battle at Megiddo. And they're all mourning for him. You can read about that in 2 Chronicles 35. But the point I want to make about that is that in that chapter, in 2 Chronicles 35, which this Zechariah text references to, there's a Passover. And King Josiah, it says in verse 18, and there was no Passover like to that kept in Israel from the day of Samuel the prophet, neither did all the kings of Israel keep such a Passover as Josiah kept. And then in 20 it says, and after this, then it goes into account where Josiah goes out to meet the Egyptian king. He gets killed. They mourn for him. I can't explain all of the things that might be going on in these verses. But the point is, the battle does not result in a carnage. It results in a heart condition, which comes after a Passover. Again, tying in the concept of the Passover, that the complete firstborn body is complete. And then there's an understanding of what has happened. All of these texts on your handout have to do with a heart condition. God said, my son, give me thine heart. And he said, keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. I'm just going to take one or two more minutes, Brother Dan, and then you can close. But the point of all this is where I have come with this. Since I made this handout that's in front of you, I've changed my mind on the meaning of this word. And there's information on this handout that comes from my mind at the time when I produced this that I don't believe now. It was made at a time when I was under the influence that I thought Armageddon was an event. And I am no longer inclined to believe that now. Not an external event that you can witness with your human eyes or you can participate in or the world can see, but rather it's an inward condition that God is gathering to so that the actual visible world events that happen can have their positive result that God intends. It does not come out of events. It comes out of the heart. And only God can deal with that object right now in such a way as to prepare it for events to come, for there to be positive results to come out of it. Only God can do that. And we cannot see that happening. Remember, we are in a time of darkness, and that tabernacle is filled with smoke. We don't know everything that's going on. It's also looked upon as a future event. And I don't think it's future. I think it's right now. I think the hearts are being prepared so that when the sixth plague is complete and the seventh one takes place, which is poured upon the air in Revelation, it'll be upon the firstborn, the symbolical firstborn of Egypt. The hearts will have already been prepared and are being prepared now for that event so as to convert them. The result will be seeing God's glory, both for the Jew then and for the rest of the world subsequently. May the Lord add his blessing.